Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Writing the Rapids, the show where I, Joe Bilecki, talk to writers about writing. Very often, those writers have been recommended to me by writers who have previously been on the show, or it's a rejoinder episode, which this is. Once again, we talked to Sam Richard, the author of Grief Rituals, Sabbath of the Fox Devils, and the award-winning To Wallow in Ash and Other Sorrows. He's edited a bunch of anthologies, including the cult hits Profane Sorcery and The New Flesh, and his short fiction has appeared in over 40 publications. He was widowed in 2017. He slowly rots away in Minneapolis, where he runs Weird Punk Books. You can talk to him at Sammy Totep across socials or at weirdpunkbooks.com. Today, we are talking about his new short story collection, The Still Beating Heart of a Dead God. And before we get into that, let's go ahead and ask you for your support. For just $2 a month, you can become a member of my Patreon at patreon.com/noisemakerjoe. That allows you to get these episodes about a day or two earlier than everybody else. Or you can throw a one-time donation over to me at paypal.me/noisemakerjoe. You can buy my book. It's called Tired. It's on Amazon. It's pretty good. Or tell a friend about us if you like the show. If you don't like the show, tell somebody you don't like about it. Either way, we both win. Now, without further ado, let's get into my conversation with Sam. The Still Beating Heart of a Dead God is the third book that I finished this year and so far my favorite, which is great. I read some more commercial stuff earlier, right around the turn of the year, and was kind of disappointed with them a little bit. So it was nice to go back to indies and be like, ah, yes, that's right. Just because I can't find it on the shelves of Barnes & Noble doesn't mean that it's not, you know, really good. Obviously, I think everything I have on the show is really good, or I wouldn't have it on the show. But I liked it.
Thank you.
One of the things, as I was taking notes, I noticed, I guess it was kind of like the first thing that I really noticed, aside from reading The Spiraling Cadaver and saying to myself, I've read this before. Where did I read this before? And then realizing that you read it on the full length that we did.
That's right. Yeah, I read like with the first kind of portion of it.
It was the strangest deja vu ever, because I was like, I don't think I have the anthology. And then it dawned on me, and I felt silly. But beyond that, as I was reading The West Within and Body Alone, and then it appeared again in Alone on the Stage Tonight, this idea of kind of being in two places at once, the protagonist kind of like seeing themselves in these, like, not like a Lynchian doppelganger sense, but in this sort of like they're being, I don't know, like expanded into two places, or having like the supernatural draw them into another place while they're still where they're at. Which is a concept I guess I haven't really encountered before and thought was really interesting.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I don't even know where I'm like, this is going to sound maybe weird. I'm like an intuitive writer, right? I don't typically plot stuff out. Longer work I might plot out roughly, and I usually kind of know the ending, and it's all about trying to get there. But for short stories, I usually have the idea, and again, I might kind of know where it's going, or maybe even assume where I think it might go without necessarily 100% being in that and fully understanding it yet. It's like a puzzle that I'm solving as I'm writing. And that's just how my brain works. I don't know. So a lot of this stuff, like a lot of decisions I make are like just intuition. I'm not usually like, oh, and then the like logic of the story dictates, like I want it to make sense within the logic of the story. I don't really care about the logic of our world, but I care that the story has a consistent internal logic. But this is going to sound so fucking stupid, but it just kind of flows out of me, and it just kind of, and I think that specific feeling, that specific sensation that I know, like that, now that you said it, I'm like, oh yeah, I do that on occasion. I've done that more than once. I really think is informed by being in shock, which is a component in a lot of my work, I think, is various, especially the very grief-heavy stuff, right? Is so much of that is, and we even, I believe, have talked about this, right? The way that shock, you're easily led when you're in a state of shock. You're easily manipulated, you're easily pulled places by people, even just physically, but also like emotionally, intellectually. And there's other sensations, there's other things related to shock, and certainly the kind of feeling like you're two places at once, feeling like your body might be one place, but your mind is somewhere completely else, is something that I know I've experienced. It's a kind of right, like sometimes people talk about horrific experiences that they've been through, that they've survived, where they feel like they're looking down on it, and not even in a like, I died for 30 seconds way, but even, but just a, you know, just terrible events that might not even be physical. That sensation of feeling like you're looking down, or you're looking at yourself from another perspective, from another place. And I think that that's probably my best guess is that I'm pulling from that kind of stuff.
So, yeah, I like that. One of the things I had been kind of mulling over in my mind, one of the things I think about a lot with regard to like spiritual stuff. The turning of the year returned me to like reading Wikipedia pages about old Slavic pagan gods, because that's just a thing that happens in the winter for me. It's just like I gotta see what Wikipedia says about Veles. And trying to like create a logic around how that might work, right? Coming from a Catholic background where that sort of logicking is kind of discouraged, right? It's very much just like, not just, it's faith, just trust the process, right? And a lot of times, you know, that's viewed very cynically, and I've been guilty of viewing it cynically too. But in viewing, you know, in thinking about non-Christian, non-Abrahamic spirituality, allowing myself to provide a logic to things. And this idea that I was thinking of the story Flatland, right? Where there's the ball, the circle, the 2D circle that meets a 3D object, or goes to the 3D plane or whatever, and tries to like describe it to people, and how things kind of like phase through. And I was thinking, oh, pagan gods could work like that. They could be operating on like a four-dimensional spatial plane, and that's how they can like appear and then disappear and be in multiple places at once. And so that's what the sort of like both and I'm here sort of is thinking about. It's kind of being like taken out of this third dimensional area, and kind of being like separated as intense things are happening. This like, I don't know, this outpouring of energy allows a splitting to happen. But your intuitive writing, one, that's how I work too, and particularly with longer works, I'm trying hard to like keep that sense of excitement and discovery while also like thinking about things like themes and foreshadowing and stuff like that. But within shorter works, like, yeah, it's just playing jazz. Like the idea is the rhythm section, and then I just pop up with my trombone and I'm like, let's see what happens here.
I'm glad I'm not alone in this.
Oh God, no. Within like the community of writers who are writers so that they can be on the internet talking about how they like are writers, there is this kind of like perennial, are you a discovery writer or are you a planner sort of thing. But I also know that you're a very iterative writer, with regard to like your themes. And so was kind of looking for that too, and noticed that, your stories, as they were like ordered in the book, had like would overlap a little bit in terms of images or themes or something. So like, Flesh Cross and Jizz Christ had these like religious icons, and then you go into Portrait of a Red Tower and it's the piece of art that is creating an obsessive sort of thing, which I really liked. I don't know how like intentional you were with the structuring of how the stories were ordered in the book.
Yeah, it was a little, this is going to sound like super shitty. It was a little slapdash. I don't mean that I didn't consider it, but I didn't go through and like spend a ton of time reading each story multiple times in different, or like reading the book different ways in different orders. I thought about what the stories feel like to me, and I would read portions of them next to each other, like end and then beginning. It was mostly like, it was vibes based. I was really just feeling out, like when I kind of came up with even just deciding the final table of contents, you know, other stories were excluded, stories that I didn't think were going to go here ended up going in here because it just felt right. So it was kind of vibes based, but I considered more like, yeah, how they feel next to each other versus like what themes connect them or might not connect them. It is interesting that you like, I love that you brought up the Jizz Christ, Portrait of a Red Tower, even the Flesh Crucifix thing. Is I don't want to say that like my stories all take place in one shared universe, because that's not necessarily true. And I don't think I'm like Laird Barron about it, where I'm like, oh well, these six stories take place in this universe and these 12 and that, you know, like, but I have an overarching universe. I don't think that thoroughly about my own work just personally, but there are stories that do take place in the same, and they take place in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. or St. Paul, and there are like actual locations that are in the stories that people who have spent time here might recognize. And I've had that happen with readers, but also specifically the art gallery, the DIY art gallery that's in Jizz Christ, that's in Portrait of a Red Tower, it's in a couple other stories I've written, is a place that doesn't exist anymore. Like my version of a place that doesn't exist anymore that used to be here in like 2005. Mm-hmm. Or something, 2008, like somewhere around there. We had this DIY space. It was like used for the basement bands would play, like in Jizz Christ, right? They go to the basement, there's this band that's based on a real band that's like a friend of mine was in. It had gallery space upstairs, but it wasn't always for galleries. They would do makers markets there. They would do education. It was kind of a radical leftist like DIY space, and I went to a lot of art shows there at the time. They like in the couple few years they were open, like an ex of mine and I, we were there all the time, and I just like, I was like, I gotta remember that piece of Minneapolis. And then it just kept making sense for it to like, okay, like putting that in there. I think I made a concerted effort, kind of the crop of stories that encompasses a lot of this book. It's like from a, you know, this more recent era of my writing. I was like, there are certainly still, right, there are like widow or sad partner loss stories in here that'll be a thing I'll always return to. But I was also like, I need to tap back into other parts of myself that I felt like, I don't know that I abandoned because it's still me, but I was like shying away from. And I had this, if I go on this ramble, sorry, but I had this realization a number of years ago where I submitted a story. It got rejected, like to an anthology or a magazine, I don't remember which. It got rejected. I was not happy with it when I submitted it. Mm-hmm. And it's actually in grief rituals. It's a "May She Eat of You Endlessly" story with the shitty punk and the art, another art related thing, but like in the kind of art studio space. And when I initially wrote that story, it was like the main character was a cipher. The main character was this thing that I was having to project in my professional life, something that like isn't me, but is kind of me. And it's like they use the term code switching, right? Like this is a thing for people of color who grow up in, upper class communities, but also have roots in more impoverished communities and working class communities, where they feel like they have to kind of code switch between the worlds they live in. That's a thing. It's like a class thing too, right? It's a mm-hmm. racial thing. It can come from all sorts of marginalizations, but it and also like people, who are like have autism and whatnot. Like, so with class stuff, like it is also a thing, especially if you grow up, like for me, right? Like I grew up super poor. And then I found myself eventually in a career where I'm surrounded by people who that is not their background. And it was very alienating. And it felt really weird. And I felt like I kept kind of falling into this character of who I was supposed to be professionally. And it started bleeding into my work. And it's like in an insidious way that really makes me feel sad and grossed out now. But part of that was like, I had written this story and it got rejected and I wasn't happy with it. And then I was like, no, like, why am I doing this? Why am I writing characters that aren't reflective of me in this way, that aren't reflective of my life, of my friends' lives? So fuck that. I'm going to start really leaning into this aspect of myself, who I am in regard to poverty, who I am in regard to being part of like weirdo subcultures. And that component had kind of been there, but it was starting to like weirdly fade in this way that felt really uncomfortable the more I reflected on it. So I started, like, this book has a lot of these stories where it's like, no, like shitty punks, because that's what I've been my whole life, and like weird DIY artist shit. And so that all like kind of pulled together into this, like, okay, if I'm pulling from my experiences in my 20s of living in punk houses, I'm pulling from like a lot of other facets of my life at that time, which to tie that rant together ends at like these weird particular spaces that don't exist anymore here.
Yeah. No, I like that. I mean, it is no secret that shitty punks are like my favorite thing to read about. Because I grew up more middle class, and like all my friends were poorer than me, but it was still an okay suburb, right? So like I never really kind of experienced a real kind of poverty, but like looking back, like one of my friends basically lived alone because his parents were divorced and his dad was a long haul trucker. And like another friend, his parents were divorced, and at some point around middle school, he had two older brothers who were like 6 and 8 years older than him. So they would have been in their teens, like late teens, early 20s, around this time. And they moved out and he just moved in with them rather than living with his mom, or going to live with his dad. So like, I always say it that like, if my parents were just a little bit less attentive, or if like my friends took a couple more risks, like the scummy teenager books that I read all the time as an adult would have been much closer to my life. And so I feel like a really intense affinity for those types of people. and in fact, as I was like, you know, as I was poking around deciding to get you back on, it was the whole, like, a bunch of punk teens trying to burn down a church that keeps regrowing. And I was like, oh yeah, this tailor made for me. I'm reading this book. I must read this book. And indeed, like, you know, that was a great short story as well.
Thank you. Yeah, that I'm really proud of that one. I'm never sure how that one has been received by people. But it was, I don't know, it was like, you gotta get weird with it. It's like, what's a way to super weird up like 90s black metal shitheads, but also make them awesome and like not Nazis? You turn them into a bunch of awesome like queer punks, and then you make it so the church keeps regrowing. Yeah, that was a story that like kind of lived in my brain for a really long time and was sort of hard to crack. You have those stories, right, that like just sort of you sit down and it mostly just kind of comes out, and then you edit it and you make some fixes and you read through it a million times to make sure that it makes coherent sense and works and you're happy. But then there are those other stories, at least for me, right, that are like a purge or a tooth extraction or an exorcism or like pulling a thread of a ball of yarn that's a tangle in your stomach and you're like slowly trying to pull it out and get it untangled. And that story was definitely took significantly longer than it should have. I was past, thank God, Mae Murray, who published that in Book of Queer Saints 2 originally, was very patient with me as I was over deadline and over word count when I turned that in, which I'm normally like try to be pretty good, but yeah, God bless her for that.
Yeah, I know what you mean with that feeling. And it is, I think what it is, right? I described writing short stuff as like playing jazz. And sometimes you do have a piece where it's like, no, this is like an orchestra. This is, I have to write every note down. I have to get it right. And man, do I sympathize with that, especially as like the intuitive discovery type writer, because you're like, you discover your way into something or vibe your way into something, and you're like, no, that's not right. Like, this is fine, but it's not what the story is. You're like sculpting something away, rather than like slopping clay together.
And that one was particularly strange to kind of unfurl because it's not told in sequence. It's like it's in pieces out of order. There's repetition, like textual repetition every time they try to burn down the church. And that became a really intense challenge to, I haven't, that I can recall, I don't know that any of my like contemporary published work other than that story is written out of sequence. And that was a thing that I like when I was writing in my 20s, stuff that'll never see the light of day, that never saw the light of day. I was trying that a lot because I was reading a lot of stuff that did that. And I was like, that sounds awesome to try this story. It suddenly started feeling like, oh, like this part we're reading isn't the first part of this story. I mean, it's never the first, but it's not the first part even textually of the story. Like now I need to figure out how to like work both forwards and backwards from that moment, and then figure out what order those events play out for the reader in, and how obvious is it that it's, not in order. That was definitely part of the challenge with that one.
Yeah, you're adding a whole other layer on top of it. Do you find that you tend to be a bit of a mirror for whatever it is you're like consuming at the time? So like, do you find if you're, I don't know, reading something kind of different from what you're normally reading, that your work tends to become more like that?
I think that that's something that I probably fight against, is I don't, I'm not of the mind, I think this is going to sound really ha harsh to vague people out there. I think it's cowardly when writers, especially aspiring writers, go, I'm not going to read anything because I don't want it to impact my work. I think that's like, just fucking read. Like, that's not how it works, really. Like, I mean, come on. You have to consume the thing to know the thing. You have to consume the thing to let it course through your veins.
Right.
So not on that track. But I tend to, I think, not try to not pull from anything I'm reading at any given time, like while I'm writing. I think I often, now that like really thinking about it, I think I often am writing stuff that's decidedly different from anything I'm reading, like in a particular moment, or at least I try to. When it like going through this phase of like we talked about on the last rejoinder, right, doing profane altars and profane sorcery, doing that, like reading a lot of sword and sorcery stuff. And I'm currently working on a couple sword and sorcery stories for like the next profane sorcery zines, and I'm deliberately not reading any sword and sorcery right now. Like I'm reading, Nathan Ballingrud and some nonfiction, because I just like I want those vibes in my brain, but I don't necessarily want those vibes in my brain while I'm writing, like at the same time that I'm writing those things, because then it gets too like, wait, am I pulling from that or am I pulling from me? Whereas I'd rather like I read a book 2 weeks ago. So now if there's a like not deliberate pulling from it, it's like mangled and strange and like fucked up by memory and haze. So I think I probably, there have been moments throughout my writing, I don't know, career, I guess, throughout writing stories in my writing career, where I have leaned into that to try to get certain vibes. The second to the last story in To Wallow in Ash, the Death Like Love, the petite necrophilia story that's like super harsh and intense, is one of my favorite things I've ever written. So personal, so raw. I deliberately reread Georges Bataille's Blue of Noon before I started writing that story, because I knew that I wanted that story as like a pivotal influence on it, which was a novella that I'd read before and loved, but I was like, I want that like upfront in my brain while I'm writing this. So I'm like kind of borrowing those vibes, even though the story is not the same. So I've been known to do that at times, but I think more casually, like non-research based and not trying to pull a vibe, it's usually more like fighting against doing that.
Interesting. Okay. I'm the exact opposite way.
Yeah, you said you like you want a full like
Yeah.
full immersion in those styles
I'll
and
make a
genres.
Pinterest board. I'll like make a playlist. Absolutely. Like, I think the last time we talked, I was toying around with some dark fantasy stuff. And yeah, I would just like at work, not even writing, just like pull up the Dark Souls OST on YouTube. Right, just to like kind of keep myself, and I find probably the reason why I do that is because I'm so much like a puppy with ideas, right? So I have to really like curate the environment where it's like, nope, we're changing the desktop background to a castle. Like we can't do anything else until we until and. As happened, I wrote like 10,000 words and got a different idea, and I'm working on that idea now, which is why I have one book out, right? Like, and that's fine because, the writing is the fun part, and the idea that is the best will be the one that keeps me engaged. But,
I will, of what you're saying, I will do one of the things you're talking about, the soundtrack thing.
okay,
I
good.
definitely do that. I like, if I'm writing sword and sorcery, I'm listening to Dungeon Synth. If I'm writing other, if I'm writing the other kind, I mean, the other kinds of things I tend to write, the non, the just straight weirdo horror shit, it's a lot of like, depending on the vibe, it's usually film soundtracks, but it's like Howard Shore's Crash soundtrack is one of, like, I listen to that a million times, or Johan Johannesson's stuff, like First and Last Man or Mandy, like drench me in those
Yeah.
vibes.
Oh man, his loss was a absolute tragedy.
Absolutely. It
For
was not okay.
yeah. Oof. The other thing I noticed, a repeating theme was evil buildings. I wanted to bring up evil buildings. Love me an evil building. Portrait of a Red Tower was very like Machine for Pigs. like that. I also liked, with that story, a realization that I had. The last time we talked about Sword and Sorcery, we talked about how weird fiction has kind of like always been a current within fantasy. And I, a genre that I have coined, I guess, is dark internet. So like the sluts and B.R. Yeager's Amygdala Tropolis. I really like this idea of like the dark internet genre of story writing. You know, there's a lot of kind of like internet sleuthing going on in Portrait of a Red Tower. He's DMing strangers and playing GeoGuessr basically you know, looking around on Google Maps for stuff and realizing that using the internet as a setting for weird fiction is a really good idea.
Yeah, that one, so that initially came out in All Will Writhe, which was the like a zine, limited zine chapbook that I did, where it's four stories, and they're all kind of heavily influenced by Ligotti and Kathy Koja, and Bentley Little as well, because I think that there's a weird, people don't talk about it, don't acknowledge it, but I think that there's a weird thing where some of Ligotti and some of Little's work is so similar that it could be written by either of them. but anyhow, so I was like on this tear of like, I want to write, like Koja is a perennial influence. I also love Ligotti, but I never, like his influence will like crop up in my work at times. I'm sure people can see, maybe, I don't know, maybe not. But for me, I'm like, oh yeah, that's like, I'm kind of pulling from that. But this was like a deliberate, like, I want to do, like, I want to lean into that kind of vibe. I don't want to pastiche. I want to do my version of, like, what does that look like? Which is always the goal. It's like, I never want to rip anybody off or just try to, like, copy them. It's like, no, what does it look like if I try to do X, Y, and Z? And that's where that story came from, is my favorite Ligotti story is The Red Tower. Which I don't know if you've read that one, but it's fucking amazing. It's one of those stories that like has no characters. It's literally just about this tower, this building, and then these objects that are built, that are like created somehow in this building and find their way into people's homes. And it's just a really strange, unsettling, fucking really cool story. And I was like, so that, I guess I say I don't do pastiche. This is the closest I've ever come to playing in someone else's playground, where I went like, what does the world with that, like wherein that tower exists or these towers or whatever exists look like? And so I was like, well, this guy finds this fucking photograph and gets obsessed. And because I felt the, you're saying with the, I like really like the dark internet stories, like dark internet genre, that feeling, which I don't really feel as much these days. And maybe it's because the internet is like fundamentally broken now. Or if it's just, I don't have the kind of time I had in my 20s or even like teenage years of just going down these weird rabbit holes of like, you're doing Google searches on some weird obscure topic or some strange thing. And then it's dumping you into message boards. It's dumping you into websites that like just someone created about a thing that tangentially is related. And I like loved that feeling and the way that that could get weird or creepy or, you know, unsettling. Like I kind of wanted to like, okay, like what does that, how do I do that in a story? And I was personally really happy with the results of that, but it is like that thing, like on the person's, what is it, like Flickr page or whatever, like literally finding photos, looking through other photos, trying to find who took the photo. It's I don't know. I think we've all, I've been there in book cover stuff, right? Like shit, I saw this photo on some regional website, like news website, even like independent journalism, regional news website, who took that photo because it's incredible. And I want to see if I can use it for like a book cover. That's literally the story of the Feral Architectures cover, that fucking photograph. I was looking for a certain kind of vibe and I found it. And then I had to like backtrack to like the person who found or who took the photo and message them and be like, can I pay you to use this for a book cover? I will be manipulating it, but like, are you cool with that? So I had fairly recently kind of done that. And I think that's also part of why it was in my brain. We'll be right back.